This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Ringgit and Cents, brought to you by OCBC Bank.
Bemused football managers, BFM 89.9.
Ringgit and Cents, brought to you by OCBC Bank.
Good morning, welcome to the show that's all about personal finance. I'm Lee Chui Lin. On today's episode, we're going to revisit an old topic, but one that's very close to our hearts. It's about will writing. This is going to be the first of a two-part series on how you can write a will easily, what are some boxes you should tick off when writing a will, and after that, we'll look at some personal finance headlines, including how your majors and degrees can affect your lifetime earnings. But first, Julian Ng speaks with Max Yong, founder of thywillbedone.com.my, an online will writing service.
Why don't we start with this very basic question of why do I need a will?
Well, basically, most people defer writing a will simply because of the inconvenience and the cost. And of course, the lacking in knowledge of the necessity of having a will. It is important to write a will so that we can provide and protect our loved ones when we pass on. There are many, many outstanding issues that will be left hanging in the air if you do not have a will. Because without a will, one would then have to go into the process of appointing an administrator in the courts, and that would take about 3 months or more. And
right.
In that period, everything that the deceased owned would be frozen. And that's when the family would be left vulnerable. Whereas with a will, the bank accounts, at least the bank accounts, can be operated by the appointed executor almost, in fact, immediately.
I guess one of the disadvantages of having your assets frozen is the fact that if the deceased dies with both assets and liabilities, and then the assets are frozen, the liabilities in the meantime need to be covered. What are the consequences of actually not having enough money to cover those liabilities?
Firstly, if the liabilities exceed the assets, so to speak, the creditors will firstly lodge a so-called caveat in the courts to monitor the administration of the assets. And with that, of course, the administrator's hands are pretty tight in distributing any assets or liquidating any assets, because they have to take into consideration the creditor's stress. In that respect, we have to look at the areas which we need to cover. With the will, at least not only the creditors has to be taken care of, but also what about the sustenance of the family that we have to consider.
Can the creditors actually go after the family and the assets of the family?
Yes, they can. The duty of the administrator or the executor is to first pay off all the debts.
So if the family members have assets that don't belong to the deceased, can the creditors go after that? Is there a provision legally for creditors to go after that?
Well, the assets must belong to the deceased. Another way which some wills have is trust. If a trust is created, then the creditors will have no hold on the trust property. For example, some wills will have trust created for the children, and those trust property will be excluded from the hands of the creditors.
I'd like to explore the differences between a will and a trust, but before that, can you tell us what are some of the key items that should go into a will?
Basically, everything goes into the will, because in the will, we cover either specific properties or the entire immovable and movable properties. And then we also have a residuary clause. A residuary clause is a clause which will capture any assets which may not be named, or any assets or any gift which may have lapsed by reason of law. And those assets will fall into the residuary clause, where it provides for your named beneficiary. So it covers everything.
So this is for someone who has a lot of assets all over the place, and he couldn't foresee such assets at the time of writing the will, and that this clause would actually cover those assets.
If the will is a specific will, yes. If the will is a general will, then it would have been covered in one of the either movable property or immovable property segment.
So some of the items that go into the will, you obviously need your assets, then you need to decide on a way to distribute these assets. As I understand it, There are different ways of stating this distribution, isn't there? You can state it in absolute ringgit amount or as a percentage, right?
Yes, if you want to state it in specific ringgit and amount, then that would be more of a specific will. You will have to specify which asset goes to who, fixed deposit or which bank account balances goes to who. Those are very specific will. Whereas in a general will, no specific mention on the amount or the number of bank accounts. It's just generally the entire movable and immovable assets goes to A, B, or C.
So it feels as though a specific will is not as good as a general will because the value of those assets can change.
Yes.
And therefore, would you advise people to go for more of a general will?
I would advise people to go for more of a general will for the simple reason that a general will not, so to speak, tie down the hands of the testator. Any disposition of any of the specified gifts would cause the gifts to lapse. And with that happening, then you may have to change your will or rewrite your will again.
So that's to capture an update of the change in values of the assets if the will was written specifically, but then you wouldn't have that problem if it was a general will.
Indeed.
What about the other things that give legal effects to the will, like a witness?
Well, the most important point to consider in getting a witness is that the witness must not be a beneficiary of the will. And the witness spouse also cannot be a beneficiary of the will. These are the two main important pertinent points to take note of. If they are a beneficiary, either the witness or the witness spouse is a beneficiary, their gifts in the will lapse.
So if one is selected as a witness, then they know that they're no longer part of the being a beneficiary.
I'm afraid so.
Yes. But how many witnesses does a will need?
At least two witnesses.
Usually, how would these witnesses be chosen? Are they friends or are they professional colleagues or even a professional? Are there such a thing as professional witnesses?
Well, professional witnesses are normally the lawyers. Well, in the present day and age, then you have will consultants who are professional witnesses. But the witnesses are normally called upon to sign an affidavit to affirm that they actually witnessed the will. So that is the only role which a witness will play. Save and except witnessing the will at a point in time.
And so what about other things? Like, I suppose you also need an executor.
Yes, the most important person is the executor, and the executor can also be a beneficiary. Well, in normal cases, between a family setup, normally the spouse is appointed as an executor. Unless the estate is really big, then you may need to appoint a professional executor to administer a more detailed will. For simple wills, normally the spouse or one of the siblings be appointed the administrator.
So the executor can also be a beneficiary as well?
Yes.
That was Julian Ng speaking with Max Yong, founder of thywillbedone.com.my, an online will writing service. Up next, do you need to write a will if you had little assets and the difference between a will and a trust? You're listening to Ringgit & Sense on BFM 89.9.
These days, we share many things. We Instagram about food and fashion. We tweet about love and life. Here's another thing we all share: money and how it relates to our life. Basically, real-life money stories. At OCBC, we listen to your stories and give you insight on some of those real-life problems. Read it all on OCBC Bank Malaysia's Facebook page. OCBC Bank. Real Malaysians, real stories, real insights.
Breaking Financial Matters, BFM 89.9.
Good morning, this is Ringgit & Sense. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Now, Julian Ng continues his conversation with Max Yong, founder of thywillbedone.com.my.
Earlier on, you raised this issue of trust. What is the difference between a trust and a will?
Well, a trust can be set up anytime, even before a person passes on. A trust can be set up for the benefit of named beneficiaries. And once the trust is set up, the property of the trust is normally divested to the trustee, and the trustee will then hold the property for the beneficiary or manage the property in accordance to the trust.
So this is like while the benefactor is still alive,
yes,
he can set up a trust to sort of distribute assets to the trustees who are effectively beneficiaries.
Right, or even at the point of death, a trust can be set up.
Are there any advantages of a trust over a will, or the other way around?
The only advantage of a trust is that once a trust is set up, the property belongs to the trust and it is out of the hands of the owner. So creditors would have no hold over that property. That is the only advantage.
As far as will writing is concerned, do you have to have a lot of assets to write a will? What if this person does not have a lot of assets? Is he in a position to say, okay, I don't really need to write a will?
Well, actually, we are worth more than what we think. Okay. You don't have to have a lot of assets. People have this perception of assets being tangible assets. Firstly, all of us have bank accounts. And now in this day and age, all of us have access to the internet. And we do own digital assets. This is the part of the estate which have not been explored widely now, until now. Digital assets comprises of online accounts. We have blogs, we have websites, those are assets as well. We have PayPal accounts, a lot of online accounts that we subscribe to. And these accounts will not be frozen upon that if the owner of the websites have no knowledge of the death. And it is during this window, this period, that we are that is most vulnerable to fraud. Perhaps we have not reached that advanced stage of fraud as yet. There will come a time where we have scammers looking at the obituary and then hacking into accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And that is when they will start clocking.
I suppose
credit card frauds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's actually quite a serious issue. And I suppose we will be talking more about this in the second of this series of will writing, the concept of online will writing and online presence and so on. Yeah.
Well, and most people think that, you know, if you do not have a will between husband and wife, everything will go to the spouse. Well, that was the position before 1997. But after the Distribution Amendment Act in 1997, the distribution order had changed. So if you do not have a will, and if you leave behind a spouse, children, and parents, your spouse will only get 25% of your estate. And whereas your children will get 50%, and your surviving parents get 25%. And similarly, if you have a spouse and parents, and without any issue, the parents and the spouse get 50-50 of your estate. So in those instances, the spouse will be left in a very vulnerable position in handling the estate of the deceased. So all the more reason we must write a will so that the spouse and the family can be provided for and protected in the distribution aspect of the estate. And that is very, very important that a lot of people fail to acknowledge, or perhaps they do not know the extent of the distribution.
That was Max Yong, founder of thywillbedone.com.my, speaking with Julian Ng. Now we head to the section of the show that takes a look at personal finance headlines. First, from payscale.com, a new report that takes a look at how majors and degrees affect lifetime earnings, which might be a topic of even more interest now with education costs going up and the ringgit going down. It's been said in many places before, a degree in the humanities isn't exactly marketable to employers. Less kind critics have even called those degrees useless. But there's one humanities major whose graduates are doing quite well in the job market, and it's philosophy majors. Every year, payscale.com surveys 1.4 million college alumni from over 1,000 US colleges on their employment and income. And although philosophy majors rank 75th on PayScale's overall list of majors and mid-career earnings, it's the top humanities bachelor's degree in their ranking. This survey in general mainly aims to try and answer the question, how much education is enough? An advanced degree in some subjects is a sure bet for a successful, high-paying career, but for some others, you might actually just reach maximum earning potential with a bachelor's or even an associate degree. Of course, there are multiple reasons to go to college or to go to university, and to do with self-betterment, to do with gaining knowledge, and it doesn't necessarily have to be in service of a future paycheck, although I suppose that nowadays, and in general, people have always thought about what they're going to be able to do with their degree and how much they're going to earn is a major part of that, although I do hope that it doesn't kill the people who want to take a humanities degree, like me. It's not entirely useless, I promise. But in case you were wondering and you're not interested in taking up philosophy, these are the highest earning degrees according to the level that you take them at. And so if you just get an associate, then fashion design is good. If you're going to take bachelor's up to master's, then petroleum engineering trumps everybody. If you're going to go for an MBA, strategy is good. And PhD, statistics. So there you go. Of course, it's not just earning power that we're all concerned about. There's also the issue of money habits while you're actually at college. And from USA Today, the headline reads, how parents can teach their kids to manage money well at college. The need for college students to be financially literate is an often overlooked but increasingly important task for parents. And according to a 2015 US bank survey of 1,640 college students, many students are actually misinformed about essential financial facts. For instance, 60% of them believe that checks or debit card usage actually builds credit. And the good news, however, it's not all bad, is that these students are open to learning from their parents. In fact, the survey notes that 91% learned money management from their parents and 55% cite their parents as their most trusted source for financial information. Even better, many parents are happy to help. 69% of parents are very or extremely concerned with setting a good financial example for their kids. And here are some tips offered to get them going. One, ingrain healthy habits at a young age. We've talked about this before. Two, teach them to budget. Really, really teach them to budget. And also, try not to give them their allowance in one lump sum. It might make it easier, but installments actually help them to prevent overspending. Three, dole out credit cards carefully, with one expert suggesting that parents first add kids to one of their existing credit cards so that they can test drive the experience under supervision. Four, encourage students to enroll in a financial literacy class. And five, and perhaps most naturally, have them do what they do best, go online. Some apps or websites that they suggest which are good are mint.com, which electronically gathers a person's financial information into one place, including accounts, cards, and bills, and Digit, which connects to a checking account, analyzes income and spending and finds small amounts of money to safely set aside. And there's an app called Acorns, which invests spare change from everyday transactions into a portfolio. So there you go. This is, of course, related to our Real Money Story of the Week from OCBC Malaysia's Facebook page. And here we go. My parents taught me to be prudent with money since I was young, so I'm not a big spender and I'm a low risk taker. My investments are low risk. I know many people tell me I can make gain in investments like foreign currency, but somehow I just can't do it. Learning from my parents, I hope to be able to guide my 2-year-old son to be smart about money from young. He understands money is used to buy things. He has a piggy bank. He has a cash register machine toy. We also involve him in the paying process when we eat out and shopping. For some unknown reason, he's only interested to buy shoes at the moment. What I will say is this. I mean, we've talked extensively about how important it is to get the education right, to start teaching children the right money habits. And I think perhaps if you can involve them in play, having a cash register toy, having a piggy bank, things like that, it kind of naturally leads into good habits later on, or perhaps makes it easier to introduce more complex concepts later on when it'll become more necessary. And when it comes to shoes, I hope he's got good taste. Quality shoes are important. I think it's never too young to learn not to be involved in fast fashion. Think of cost per wear. You might be spending a little bit more now, but you might be able to wear it for longer, which is a tip that I think even some adults can't quite fathom. So a 2-year-old son, go. Presumably, however, that kid is not this kid, because OCBC also have What Kids Say About Money on the Facebook page. And this child, when asked what he wanted to be when he grows up, is, I want to be a doctor with 50,000 ringgit salary. I will save my salary for 5 years so that I can buy my dream car, a Bugatti Veyron 16.4 grand sport. When told he might need to save some money for food and house, he says, for that, I'll just stay with you and daddy and you'll pay for everything. So it sounds as if these people could probably trade parenting tips at this point, and maybe spread some of that money education the way of this future doctor to help him out with his finances. For more updates, you can visit OCBC Malaysia's Facebook page, facebook.com/OCBC.Malaysia. They've got money hacks, they've got surveys, they've got money stories. So do check it out. And that is it for our show this week. Thank you very much for listening. As always, if you've got questions or if you've had some wonderings, some musings on what to do with your money, Do drop us an email. We do answer your questions at the end of every month on our Ringgit Ring-In special. And write into us. That email is ringgit@bfm.my. That is it. Thank you for listening. You've been listening to Ringgit and Sense on BFM 89.9.
Ringgit and Sense, brought to you by OCBC Bank. Real Malaysians, real stories, real insights.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.